supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. A program in New Jersey that helps struggling cities is ending for places such as Camden, Trenton, and Newark. The Urban Enterprise Zone program allowed businesses in certain cities to charge half of the state sales tax. It also gave companies the opportunity to buy equipment and materials tax-free. But for five cities, the program expired at the beginning of this year. And as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, companies in those cities are starting to feel the sting.
Bill Goodwin has worked at Franklin Griffith Electric in Trenton for almost 20 years, and he says throughout that time, he's had lots of customers, mostly electrical contractors, come in to buy switches or light bulbs just so they could pay half the sales tax.
We know for a fact that there's been customers through the years, especially Pennsylvania customers, that drive specifically to Trenton to take advantage of that savings.
In fact, Goodwin says 15% of his business in 2015 came from customers going out of their way to pay the lower sales tax rate. But in Trenton and four other cities in New Jersey, that perk is no more. Starting this year, the first five so-called urban enterprise zones in New Jersey expired, which means customers in those cities now have to pay the full sales tax. And it also means that businesses in those cities can no longer make company purchases tax-free.
I mean, if something costs $1,000 without sales tax, it costs $1,070 with sales tax, and those dollars add up.
Steve Schwartz runs PCM, a Camden company that makes environmental testing equipment and applies functional coatings like Teflon. He says the cost of materials and equipment just went up.
You know, you have a budget, and you have to live within your budget.
A proposal that passed the New Jersey legislature in December would extend those low-tax zones for 2 years. Whether it becomes law is now up to Governor Chris Christie. He vetoed a proposal earlier last year that would have granted 10-year extensions. But the current bill has some of the changes Christie wanted, so he may be more open to an extension this time around. Goodwin from Franklin Griffith Electric says it's exactly the kind of thing Christie should be supporting.
He talks a good game. He talks about helping small business. But if he really wants to help small business, then this is something that he needs to do. This is something he needs to sign.
But for now, businesses and customers in distressed cities are having to shell out a little bit more. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
As Atlantic City's gambling economy declined in recent years, casinos seem to keep popping up in Pennsylvania. Joining us to discuss the health of Pennsylvania's own gaming sector is Robert Ambrose of Drexel Center for Hospitality and Sports Management. Robert, thank you for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you asking me to be here.
It's been 10 years since slot casinos opened in Chester and Bensalem. Casinos were new to Pennsylvania then, and Atlantic City was a lot stronger then. Is it different now?
Well, yes. Pennsylvania is number two in the country, right under Las Vegas. When casinos first came to Pennsylvania, after a few years, they ran a very strong third. With Atlantic City's changes in recent years, Pennsylvania has definitely moved into a very comfortable second place.
When it comes to total wagers, Parks does the best in Pennsylvania. More than Harrah's, more than Sugar House in Philadelphia, more than Valley Forge. Why is that?
In real estate, the term location, location, location is always bandied about. And they've had a very aggressive, strong marketing approach. And their location is just very centralized. Whereas Valley Forge is in a unique situation with a convention center and also a very lovely property. But they all have their niche. And that's one of the things that I admire about Pennsylvania. When they made this original plan, that they diversified the market throughout the state, giving opportunities for different types of venues, such as Pocono Downs and Valley Forge. And the best way to say it is it spreads the product around, and I think it was a very strong move and a smart move when they conceived this idea some years ago.
Now, Philadelphia has a second casino licensee granted. Is there capacity for a second casino in Philadelphia? Do you see that?
I believe there is. Philadelphia is a very strong market, as you know, for tourism and hospitality, and it definitely has room for both. And I'll take that a step further, because it is not just about the casino product. It's the non-gaming product as well.
But you talked about location, location, location earlier. Once you put a casino in South Philadelphia, are you going to see what happened to Atlantic City? Once there was more capacity, there was a struggle for some of the weaker links.
I don't believe so. And Atlantic City is, and I've often said when people ask me what my thoughts are, I ask them to sit down and give me a couple of days, because there are a variety of issues, and it took decades for Atlantic City to reach the point that they are now. And it was not because of the glut. It was because of the lack of diversification of the marketplace. And as I mentioned, we talk a lot now about the non-gaming entities in terms of what hospitality can bring. And really, the casino itself is just part of everything else. I tell my students it's like looking at a big pie, and there's several slices, and there's a little something for everyone in that mix.
Looking at the future, what do we see coming next?
Next in gaming? Oh, absolutely skill-based product. There's no question in mind. I'll clarify that. Skill-based product is just starting to hit the floor, and basically it is a marketing target for the millennials who have grown up in the video games, and it brings more of a challenge to the player rather than the traditional slot machine being a game of chance. Caesar introduced in November at their properties in Atlantic City a very early form of skill base, and I definitely see it trending upward as it gets more sophisticated. At G2E this year in Las Vegas, which is the annual gaming convention, the focus was totally on skill-based gaming and all of the new product coming out. So that is definitely the future, and that too will be part of the equation. It's going to be another slice of that particular pie. It can't all be about gaming anymore. That was part of Atlantic City's issue.
Robert Ambrose, instructor at Drexel's Center for Hospitality and Sports Management, thank you for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
And thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure being here.
It's been two full years since the Washington Post started tracking fatal shootings by police. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports that in 2016, as in the year before, many were mentally ill.
One in four people shot by police over the last 2 years showed signs of mental illness, according to the Washington Post's analysis. That includes Kim Thomas's son, Earl Pinckney, who had bipolar disorder. Pinckney was shot and killed by police last August in Harrisburg. Thomas's granddaughter called the police because she was frightened by a domestic dispute.
I said, please don't shoot my son, because I just felt like they just want to shoot him for no reason.
The police had been called to the house several times before. The Harrisburg Police Department declined to comment because the incident was investigated by the Dauphin County DA. The district attorney cleared the officers in November, citing officers' reports that Pinckney threatened his mother with a knife. But Thomas isn't satisfied, saying that the department needs a specially trained team to respond to incidents like this.
Not to come to kill, to let the situation calm down if it's a situation. Not to pull your guns out right away.
Arthur Evans, the commissioner of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health, believes that crisis intervention training can go a long way toward having fewer deadly interactions. The 40-hour course teaches officers to recognize if someone is in psychiatric crisis.
What the training does is it gives the officers a different way of responding in those situations.
In Philadelphia, in the last 2 years, seven people were fatally shot by police, but none showed signs of mental illness. Evans says that several years ago, before crisis intervention training was implemented, some fatal shootings did involve people with mental illness. John Snook of the Treatment Advocacy Center says training is good, but police shouldn't be on the front lines of administering what he sees as mental health treatment. He believes the answer is more beds at inpatient facilities and intensive treatment.
We're never going to train our way out of these incidents. We need to ensure that people aren't allowed to get so sick that they're posing that sort of danger to themselves and others.
Others who were fatally shot while showing signs of mental illness in our region include Jeremy McDowell in Wilmington, who police were told had a gun, and Oscar Camacho in Camden, who was talking about suicide before he was killed. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
All over the country, coal miners will be watching President-elect Donald Trump to see if he keeps promises made during his campaign to revive the coal industry. That message helped Trump win over voters in Pennsylvania's coal country. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports many of these voters aren't expecting Trump to perform miracles, but they do want him to put coal first.
Stand outside a supermarket in Greene County in the southwest corner of the state and ask people what they want from the incoming president. You'll hear this a lot.
A lot of the coal miners are out of work, and their families are in need of work, as well as the construction aspect. I feel that there's a lot of people out there without jobs in this time of the year. They need jobs.
I just hope for better change within the next 4 years for the coal miners.
I would like to see more jobs and less imports. I am definitely against imports.
Dean Courtright, Alyssa Strope, and Kent Knight all want some version of the same thing, a return of industrial jobs, like coal mining, to this part of the state. Greene County has lost a third of its jobs in coal mining, its largest industry, over the last 4 years. And Donald Trump, who's promised to slash environmental regulations on coal, won the county by 40 points. So now what? What do the voters who put Trump in the White House want? In a word, jobs. It's been over a year since the coal mine Dave Hathaway worked in closed. He spent most of 2016 sending out resumes looking for work. The search gained urgency when his son Deacon was born in August.
I like when he gets milk drunk and just passes back out. A little coma.
Hathaway's union, the United Mine Workers of America, traditionally supports Democrats. But these last two election cycles in 2012 and 2016, it hasn't endorsed any presidential candidate. In November, Hathaway gave Trump his vote.
I voted for Trump. I mean, a coal miner would be stupid not to.
Hathaway just got hired at a nearby mine. He thinks the election of Donald Trump means he'll have a better shot at keeping this job, even though he didn't really like a lot of the things Trump had to say during the campaign.
He is a wacko. He still is. I mean, he's never going to stop being a wacko. You know what I mean? But, I mean, the things that he did say, the good stuff, was good for the coal mining community. But we'll see what happens.
Tom Crooks witnessed the decline in coal firsthand. He's a vice president at R.G. Johnson, a construction firm that builds mine shafts.
2 years ago this week, we had 145 employees, and right now we have 22.
Crooks doesn't use the phrase war on coal, but he does think federal regulations mounted by Obama's EPA have weighed down his industry. Regulations like the Clean Power Plan, which curbs greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants. Crooks wants fewer regulation and more government research into making coal as clean as possible.
And really what's happened over the last 8 years is the smart people stopped working on coal, in part because of the way the federal government and the state governments looked at us. We just want them to start looking to coal as an option, that's all.
But wiping out regulations probably won't bring all the coal mining jobs back. That's because a big cause for coal's demise is the low price of natural gas, some of it coming from gas wells nearby. Blair Zimmerman is a Democratic Greene County commissioner and former coal miner. He supported Hillary Clinton, but he wished the Obama administration had spent more time helping coal-dependent communities like his transition their economies.
And no one's knocked at my door and said, hey, what can we do to bring manufacturing or industry? How can we help you help yourselves? That's my beef. You know, coal miners can do anything. You know, they can transition to whatever.
Instead of a return to what once was, Zimmerman wants Trump to help his community prepare for what comes next. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The newly sworn-in Republican Congress is already working to repeal the Affordable Care Act, In this week's edition of What Are We Thinking? NewsWorks Tonight, Dave Heller and Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll, look into whether or not Americans approve.
Frank, to what extent do Americans want Congress to act to repeal Obamacare?
In general, Americans do want changes in the ACA. If it really boils down to repeal and replace, using those words, it is less than 50%. We came at it in a fairly complex way where we said, do you approve or disapprove of the ACA? More people disapprove than approve. And if you disapprove, we said, do you want it repealed and replaced? And that was actually, as I mentioned, just in the 30% range. But we do have a significant percent of those who actually say they approve of the ACA, and they tend to be Democrats, saying they think it needs significant changes. So if you put the significant changes together with those who want it repealed and replaced, you're way up to 60 or 70%.
Clearly, a preponderance of the some 20 million who have signed up for the Affordable Care Act want it, if it is repealed, to be replaced.
That is correct. And I think the Republicans who are talking about repealing and replacing have said they will have some kind of safety net or plan B so that people just aren't thrown out of insurance. But that's all what we're waiting to see, how this is going to come about.
Frank, we are 2 weeks to the day out from his inauguration. To what extent does the public feel that Donald Trump will be able to handle the duties of the president?
We had asked for President Clinton, President Bush, and President Obama when they were elect, that is, when they had been elected but not yet taking office, whether they thought they could handle various aspects of the office, as you say, of chief executive. And we just asked those same questions for Donald Trump. Bottom line is, Americans are more negative on Trump than they were any of the above when we asked the same items. Not a shock, remember, Trump is the most unpopular president-elect that we have ever measured. So it is not surprising that Americans are less confident that he can handle aspects of the presidency than previous president-elects. The thing Americans are most confident in, 60%, say that he will be able to work with Congress to get things done. The things they are least likely to be positive about are that he can avoid major scandals in his administration. And they're kind of lukewarm about his being able to handle international crisis and manage the executive branch effectively and so forth. But again, in all instances, there's less confidence going into the inauguration on January 20th for Donald Trump than there was for the previous three presidents.
Now, Frank, put that competency around Donald Trump's abilities in the context of new data indicating that we are indeed becoming increasingly polarized ideologically.
That is the question that we have asked for many, many years. That is, are you conservative, moderate, or liberal? That's ideology. And a lot of people think that the American public is becoming more conservative because, after all, we now have a Republican president and the houses, both houses are controlled by Republicans. But that's actually not the case. We can go all the way back to the 1990s and find that about 36% of Americans way back then in the decade of the 90s identified as conservatives. And it's about the same percent now, 36%. That really hasn't changed. What has changed, in answer to your question, is the percent who are moderate. The percent of Americans who ideologically want to be in the middle has dropped significantly. It was way up in the 40% range. Now it's all the way down to just 34%. What's come up is the percent of Americans who say they are liberal. This is interesting. It's counterintuitive. We are becoming more conservative. We're becoming more polarized. Conservative still number one. More Americans identify as conservatives than anything else. But the number of liberals is going up. And the number of Americans who want to just put themselves in the middle is really declining. So we're in these two solid camps on either side at this point.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Finally tonight, a boys' swimming team from New Jersey's Atlantic County is receiving national attention. Justin Liu, Glenn Lasko, Brian McGrody, and Destin Lasto of Mainland Regional High School's 200-meter relay team broke the National Interscholastic Swim Coaches Association public school record yesterday. In a home meet against Atlantic County, the group finished in 1 minute 34.95 seconds. Coach Brian Booth says they didn't even know a record was broken until doing some research after the meet. The previous record was held by Monarch High School of Louisville, Colorado. The accomplishment isn't quite official, as the school's pool is waiting on certification by the Coaches Association. But once everything is in order, Booth says he'll submit the time. And the difference between Mainland's record and the previous time? Just barely over 1 second. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. The news director, Eugene Son. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our engineers this week were Diana Martinez and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. You can listen to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.